Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. A couple of weeks ago, we started a discussion about the alliance with India and the United States and sort of the almost accidental way that it's been going on, and that the ties have been increasing. And as we were talking about it, we started getting into a discussion about the Indo-Pakistani relations and what the developments were there, and how that actually it has started to cool down a little bit along the border, and that the Indians see Pakistan almost as a secondary issue now. Is that correct, Austin?
No, but maybe. let me explain that. There's a lot that you can. What you're detecting is Indian focus now on extremist Islamist organizations, Lashkar-e Taiba and the like. Not that they hadn't been focused on them, but they were all blaming them entirely on Pakistan. They aren't entirely blamable on Pakistan. They link through with Al-Qaeda and other militant Islamist organizations. India, let's go back to one of the things I said a couple of weeks ago, talking about Mumbai as being a final straw. There's only so much that, and India told Pakistan, you got to clean it up. Well, there's only so much that the really factionalized Pakistani government can do on its own. And what you're seeing, if you're detecting, Dan, is the fact that the Indians, they've got some really overwhelming power in South Asia, and they're going to use that power. They're using it diplomatically, politically, economically. When I say militarily, I'm looking at security components, intelligence, and the like. It's not that Pakistan is a secondary concern. I mean, go read material in Indian newspapers on the web just over the last 2 weeks, and you'll still see the abundant evidence of the long-term grudge between Indians and Pakistanis. Again, going back to the split up of British India, the dislocations, the people's dislocations, loss of life, and the like. To bring this to a point is that you're seeing India know that it's got the power to act in this way, and it's risen above Pakistan in the entire array of diplomatic, information, intelligence, military, and economic power. I hope that that's my answer is clear on this. That's what it's not that it's that Pakistan's diminished as an issue, the confrontation with Pakistan, or competition with Pakistan, or the old grievances, but India's asserting its power, and it's got it to assert. So I think it's basically, I think what you picked up on is a matter of perception. So,
okay.
Did that make sense to you?
Yeah, I guess the feeling I was getting in our discussions was that they're almost more concerned about their relations on their eastern borders with or northeastern borders with China and some of the others than they are with Pakistan.
I wouldn't go that far. I think that they're extremely interested in the situation with vis-a-vis Kashmir, but as for China and India eyeing one another, and China and India talking to one another as we speak. There's a high-level delegate, Chinese delegation visiting India to, if not the high-level diplomats conducting the discussion, certainly the lower level, and I'm certain the border issues and are on the table for discussion. Not that they will be answered, but they were very recognized, as well as a host of other diplomatic and especially economic trade issues that two large nations, both with expanding economies, so there are areas of competition, but there are also areas of cooperation. And that's if you're saying that India recognizes that China is both a competitor and a place for economic cooperation, that's true. Pakistan is not, and either one of those. I mean, it's a competitor, but it's not. It's not yet at the same level of economic interest to the Indians. That's for sure.
Okay. Now, have they been? What sort of cooperation has Pakistan given them as far as closing off, getting the radical Islamists shut down from coming across the border?
Are you asking me that, or
Jim? Either one.
Well, it waxes and wanes. A few years ago, when they first started to kiss and make up, there was a sharp reduction in the number of newly trained Islamic terrorists, crossing into Kashmir. Part of that was due to the fact that India had gotten cozy with Israel, who had pointed out that if they bought some Israeli night vision devices and some of the sensors that the Israelis themselves used to keep the Islamic terrorists out of Israel, they could cut down on this. And this proved to be the case, especially the night vision equipment, but also the other, silent sensors, as it were, that simply alerted the border patrols over this mountainous forested area. It's perfect for infiltration that there was someone out there. So let's go out there with the night vision goggles and see what we can find. And they began finding a lot of them. So it dropped a lot. But after the Mumbai attacks 2 years ago, the Islamic radical groups got a little more bold, and apparently with the collusion of the army and the ISI, who are big players in this pro-Islamic terrorism routine, allowed the camps to go full tilt again, the terrorist training camps, and basically authorized more of them to try and cross. The Pakistani army, who in the last decade have often been very active in helping the Islamic terrorists get across. For example, they'd open fire on the nearest Indian border guard garrison and basically draw their fire, as it were, distract them while the Islamic terrorists dashed across. They started doing this again. So basically, that era of year or so of building up trust again began to fall apart. There is apparently, and WikiLeaks confirms this, there is a big internal struggle going on inside of Pakistan over whether or not backing Islamic terrorists should be state policy. And problem is, as in many, countries that are don't really have a fully functioning government, there are several independent, groups. The ISI and army are a power unto themselves. Indeed, we see this throughout the history of Pakistan. Half of the time since independence in 1947, the army has taken over and run the country. And then, when they really wear out their welcome, there's a democracy again. So nobody's completely in charge, neither the people via a parliamentary democracy or the military. So you have to deal with both, but the army insists, oh, no. I mean, when Musharraf stepped down a couple of years ago, he said, no, the system works, I'm leaving, democracy is taking over again, and of course the other generals whispered to themselves, in a few years we'll be back. That's the way things are done. So the big problem you have in Pakistan, or one of the many big problems, is nobody's in charge. Who are you going to make a deal with?
Well, look, this what Jim describes gets back to my initial response to you, Dan, is that India's taking this on itself. Many of the actions that you see, it's Pakistan's fragmented, and it's going to act because it's got the power to act.
And the other thing with India is, India really doesn't have a choice when it comes to putting Pakistan on the back burner. They've been dealing with Pakistan since 1947, and they basically got the drill down. They devoted a lot of money and attention to dealing with Pakistan. Pakistan has continued to decline in terms of economics, in terms of military power. India has grown stronger, and now China's showing up. So who are you going to pay attention to? The old enemy who is much weaker and you've been coping with, you know, for decades, or the new guy who is bigger, has twice the GNP, has a larger arm, an armed force is twice the size of yours, and is sending warships into the Indian Ocean. Right. So India, whether it wants to or not, has to pay attention to the Chinese.
Right, and as Pakistan, as you said, it's fragmented. The threat is from radical groups and not from the Pakistani army or the Pakistani government, per se, as they're just having a hard time right now holding everything together, especially with the natural disasters that have taken place recently.
Well, the country is a natural disaster. And the big problem with the Islamic radical groups is the Pakistanis brought this on themselves back in the 70s when they decided, you know, Islamic conservatism or radicalism is the way to solve the country's problems. Most Pakistanis, even the ones who have their hands in somebody else's pocket, admit that corruption and misgovernment is the major problem in the country. And educated Pakistanis, of which there are many, they write articles in the newspapers. There are lots of newspapers. One thing, the military dictatorship back in the 80s, they basically threw away a lot of the press censorship. And so you had this free press, which outdoes themselves in coming up with CIA, you know, with conspiracy theories and reasons why, India is the cause of all of our problems. So that they are a big help. But what they have done is allow, you know, basically educated Pakistanis to say, now look, there are fundamental problems which are our fault and we have to fix. And people nod their heads and then run out and demonstrate against the CIA. You can't demonstrate against the ISI, which is their CIA, because if you become too much of a problem, they will send somebody out to kill you. Or somebody might decide to do it anyway just to be nice, you know, just to win some popularity with the ISI. So it's a dysfunctional country. And that's the big problem. They're their own worst enemy. And India has basically benefited from this because the Pakistanis become less and less military effective. I mean, what people worry about in that part of the world is the country falling apart. That's the main reason we're pouring so much money and resources into it, because it doesn't work.
Right.
And it doesn't work more year by year. So the Islamic terrorists are simply a byproduct of this dysfunctional, you know, society they have going over there. And of course, unfortunately, it's a common pattern throughout the Islamic world. And that's a problem that the West in general has to face, because the Islamic radical groups who have been trying to reform, actually they've been trying to reform the Islamic world for 1,000 years now, but that's a whole other story, obviously. But now they have easy access to the West, and, you know, that's what bin Laden and his buddies and his cronies basically decided to do back in the 90s. You know, let's go after the West. You know, maybe we can win the affection of more people in the, in the Islamic world and overthrow our own, you know, thugs and despots and tyrants and what have you. Because that is, even one thing the United States and Al-Qaeda agree upon is most Islamic countries have rotten governments. Really, we both agree on that.
Yeah.
And Al-Qaeda basically makes themselves very popular by pointing to the West and saying they support our rotten governments, ignoring the fact that where those rotten governments come from. You know, it's the old saying, we have met the enemy and they are us. Well, that doesn't fly in the Islamic world. It's always somebody else. And that's just one of the many problems they have over there. And the Indians have basically looked at that, shrugged their shoulders, and said, hey, you know, we're making progress. We got rid of our damn socialism ideas back in the 90s. The economy is booming. We have China, you know, making ugly noises at us, threatening to take one of our provinces or states away. So let's just hope that Pakistan doesn't completely blow up. The other thing is the nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons make a conventional war much less likely. The mutually assured destruction. It's not that they won't destroy each other, but they'll do a lot of damage. And no politician wants that to happen on their watch. So both the Pakistanis and the Indians are very careful not to let anything, you know, get out of control. Before the nuclear weapons were available to both sides, there was a real threat of a conventional war, because this would make a politician very popular. The damage would be restricted to the border areas, and it would soon be over. I mean, that's what happened in 99 with the Kargil War, you know, that border, you know, conflict, which was a big deal over there. It was basically ignored in the West. But there were, you know, several thousand casualties, and, you know, it was ridiculous. And the Pakistani army later admitted we started it. But then, as a result of that, both sides basically said, all right, never mind, you know, working on nuclear weapons, let's have them. And bingo, everybody was testing their nuclear weapons, India much more effectively than Pakistan, but they basically, both sides have nukes now. And that means no more Kargils. No more messing around. So things spiral out of control. A whole generation of politicians is going to be out of work, because people get very angry when you start dropping nukes on cities. Nobody wants that. So that is good. But meanwhile, India has changed its focus. They're looking east, not west.
Right.
So let me toss out something here, Dan, for our listeners. This is, I'm going to now discuss a column that I sketched out, now almost 2 years ago. And I haven't completed it yet, but it would, of course, appear in On Point. And it's called Reuniting British India, was my working title. Now, can't say that the idea is unique to me. I've actually seen and heard, I've read and heard this discussed among Indians and tangentially among Pakistanis living in the United States. But here's the geographic and demographic reason that you could see, and I'm not talking about a collapse scenario, more of a decline scenario, which we're already in. Jim's described the decline, and I described what India's power has become really overwhelming vis-a-vis Pakistan. But if you look at the way British India was organized, and then they're still within current India, I forget the exact figure, but Jim, isn't India really the second largest Muslim population on the planet? 150, 160 million, I think.
That's right, and a reunited Raj would have the same population as China.
Well,
and the largest Muslim population in the world.
Well, the thing is that you had strategic depth, geographic depth to deal with all these hill tribes. They would come pouring out of what are now the tribal areas or Afghanistan, and attack down into along the into what is now Pakistan, or even further into India. But you had large population and geographic depth to deal with them as India. Pakistan really lacks that, and they're in a situation where you're going to continue to be fragmented, fall further behind economically, despite the comparatively high level of education that does exist in Karachi, Islamabad, which Jim actually referred to tangentially a moment ago as well. I mean, there are a lot of literate people in Pakistan. But if you put British India back together, at least in the western portion and in India, Bangladesh can follow on its own, you would have the demographic and geographic depth to marginalize these hill tribes and, to some degree, marginalize the Pashtun problem that afflicts both Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, if that seems so far out, well, it may well be, but it's an interesting speculation. And it's one, again, I told you, I've read it, and I've heard it. Was it a mistake to split up British India into a predominantly Hindu and an overwhelmingly Muslim nations? Maybe. And maybe we're watching that. And maybe the Pakistanis, the largest Muslim component, are paying the price for that mistake. I just asked.
There are several reasons why the locals want nothing to do with that. The Indians, and this gets discussed over there, the Indians look at what happened in Germany when they reunited Germany.
Oh, yeah.
The wealthier Germans had to pay a lot of money, $1 trillion, to basically bail out the poor Germans. And they also look at Korea. South Korea would pay an even higher price proportionately, maybe even absolutely, to bail out their much poorer and much worse off, you know, cousins. India would have a similar problem. Not that it wouldn't help Pakistan and Bangladesh, but that brings up another problem. The people who are currently running Bangladesh and Pakistan, Bangladesh is actually very similar in the terms of how it's governed, you know, the 100 families and all that other nonsense. The current elite, as it were, people in power in Pakistan and Bangladesh know that they would lose a lot. Technically, they should have plenty of opportunity because they have money, they have capital, they have contacts, they could take advantage of a bigger market, but the fact of the matter is they would lose political power. The Indians would not put up with the degree of corruption that basically takes place in Bangladesh and Pakistan. So the local worthies in those two countries would very much resist that, and the key voting blocks in India, the people who feel that they are within reach of the good life, what we would call lower middle class, but what India they call a dream that seemed unattainable, you know, a generation ago, they're going to have to basically sacrifice that to bail out, you know, those damn Muslims.
Jim,
and you didn't find Indian Muslims saying that.
Jim, all I'm saying when I raise this, notice that I said I hadn't executed and finished the column. What you've got there is something that does, you know, the idea, again, it's at least 20 years old. That's when I first encountered it. I first encountered it. It's something that you rarely see written about in the Indian or Pakistani press, but you do hear discussed. It's not that there aren't every single one of these reasons, including all the blood spilled, or why it would be hard to do it. But the ultimate beneficiaries would be the miserable population primarily in Pakistan, and the miserable or semi-miserable population. I'll just go ahead and say miserable. I know what it's like in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, you would benefit from the comparative reduction in corruption. I'm talking about the people in Bangladesh and Pakistan. It is. Dan, I offered this idea in the same way that in, I think, the 1996 edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, Jim and I wrote about Rubik, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. You put the Rubik back together, you've got a superpower. You've got tons of Ukrainians who will object to that forever, and Kazakhs who will object to it forever as well. But don't think that isn't something that crosses Vladimir Putin's mind.
Oh, very much so. And they're abroad. Yeah, they've been working at that ever since, you know, the Soviet Union fell apart.
Sure.
But as you point out, those Ukrainians are very troublesome.
Oh, they are, and they don't like it at all. And this Rubik, I'm just saying that's another one of those reconstruction ideas. This actually makes more sense to reconstruct India than it does a reconstructed small Soviet empire. Anyway, this is one of the things you would get on strategy page. We'll at least talk about it. So.
Right. The last thing I'd like to follow up with that I think is going to have a big effect over the next year is the repercussions of the flooding. You know, almost the entire Indus Valley there in Pakistan having been flooded
5.3 million people out of work, over 2 million people displaced. But the effect is going to be on next year's food supply, whether they'll be able to plant or like that. But it could bring down the entire government next year with just the repercussions of that flooding. And also, I don't think Americans know that we still have troops out in the Aden Gulf that are supplying, helping with the flood relief. That's an ongoing event. You know, when we were in Haiti, we kept reporting on it in the mainstream media, but we haven't hardly had any reporting about what's going on in Pakistan and that we have ongoing relief efforts there.
Well, you had the same thing happening that happened last time when they had the earthquake a couple of years back. The local corruption. You know, you send stuff in there, it gets stolen. You send people in there with the goods, the relief materials, and you've got all sorts of local, officials showing up saying, oh, you have to pay a tax or you have to pay a fee or, hey, you know, if you want this to happen, maybe you should, leave a couple hundred pounds of that stuff over there for government use. The Pakistanis expected this, hoping it wouldn't happen, but they knew from past experience it would. There was a much lower international response to this, basically because the Pakistanis did nothing to basically go after the offenders from the last go-round. So you have, it's just like Somalia, where the UN found out that half the food was being stolen or misappropriated, that, was being sent in there to feed the third of the population that's starving. Although that's gone down now, they had had some good rains this year, so the local crops are being better shaped. But you still have a lot of refugees in Somalia who are starving. So you have not just a problem in Pakistan, but in many other parts of the world where the local corruption makes it difficult to basically even relieve the sufferings of victims of natural disasters. And the government may fall, but the army is ready to march back in. They never believe that they're going to be gone for good. And this will be their opportunity. So they'll make speeches against corrupt officials, and they'll make a hash of things, and they'll be out in another 5 years. I mean, nobody knows how to break the cycle.
Right. And I know the Taliban has been making noise about that they're going to try to take advantage of this problem over the next
year. And that didn't work because what happened was they were in the Swat Valley, which is this huge valley right adjacent to the tribal territories, which the lower end of it is less than a day's drive, about a couple hours drive from the capital, Islamabad. They got in there, they took over largely on the basis of the dissatisfaction of the people in the Swat Valley, which is a fairly prosperous place. The only ski resort is in the Swat Valley, or was, until the Taliban burned it down. They were upset with the corruption of the local officials. The government was dysfunctional. Taliban came in and said they would clean this up. They did, but then they imposed Sharia. Not just Sharia as the Pakistanis thought they understood it, just honest government, but hey, no school for the girls, men gotta grow beards, women can't work outside, all this stuff. These guys just have no sense of restraint, no sense at all, and they totally alienated most of the population. The army came in, the army's still there, they're still chasing down various bands of Taliban, because the Taliban believe that, hey, given a second chance, we can make it work. Well, that never works.
Right.
So the Taliban, basically the reputation of the Taliban, because that got covered heavily by the Pakistani media. So the Taliban are known bad boys now. And they're not going to make a comeback. So there we are. Another bright idea, just right. Boom, boom.
Well, it sounds
like that's a good place to.
Right.
To wrap this one up.
Yeah, I think Pakistan is headed for some still major problems over the next year, or if not the next decade. And I think we're going to see a strengthening India that they're going to become stronger and stronger.
All that's already occurring, Dan.
Yep.
It's already occurring.
And the U.S. is going to be well served if we continue to strengthen that Indian alliance.
Well, that's why they're coming to us.
Yep.
War's over. Let's line up with the winners.
Right. Well, we'll talk to you again next time, gentlemen. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.